were the major types of cases that you did handle? Mostly criminal, or was it a mix of civil? What was the flavor of the caseload?
Well, it's like in Kenai, for a while, they were mostly criminal cases and juvenile cases. They did have significant juvenile problems in Homer and Seward and in Kenai, Saldana. When I came to Anchorage, it seems to me that most of the cases I was assigned here in town were criminal cases.
Did any cases stand out in your memory? Specific cases?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I've been intending to call the Division of Corrections to see whatever happened to him. There was a case involving a 19-year-old gentleman named Mark Guest. When he was 18, he had gone into a bar and gotten into a fight with somebody in a bar on 4th Avenue and had been tossed out of there because of his age. A little while later, he was patrolling 4th Avenue and his pickup truck spotted the native gentleman with whom he had the conflict in the bar, got out and said, "Yeah, I'm sorry we had that fight, and I'm sorry I stomped on your," I guess the native had been trying to sell him some cocaine or something, and they got in a new fight over the price, and he threw it on the floor and stomped on it with an ink blotter kind of. Said, "Why don't you come out to my house and I'll give you some mushrooms. I got some mushrooms out there that I think you'd like." So they went out to his house. He came out of the house with a .44 caliber carbine and told the native man to start running. And the guy got about 7 steps and he shot him in the back. Didn't kill him. So he enlisted the support of somebody that had gone along out there. Gone with them out there, and I threw them in the back of the pickup truck and took them out to Camel Creek. And their excuses style shot him in the head and pushed him in the creek. That stands out because the community was really upset. And then it turned out in sentencing, the district attorney presented several people who said that what Mark Guest liked to do for recreation was to sit off the north-south runway out at Merrill Field and shoot at airplanes that were landing and taking off. And there had been numerous reports of holes in airplanes. Now, he didn't shoot anybody down. Got a couple of gas tanks, didn't cross fire. So I sentenced him to life without parole. And recently I've heard that he's out. And I remember drafting an order that should not have allowed him to be out till he died. So I have no authority to do anything anymore, but I'm curious enough to find out if he's out, why he's out. He's a complete sociopath. And I had a few others similar to Mark Guest, but that was quite early in my career, and he was very young. He was 19 at the time of sentencing. And both papers, we had 2 Bible papers, and you remember, made a headline for some time.
Well, back when you started off in Anchorage, as I remember it, the bars were open till 5 o'clock in the morning, closed for an hour, and then reopened at 6, and it wasn't until some years later that the 2 o'clock curfew right. was put in. So was Anchorage a more wild and woolly town because of that, or?
I think so. I mean, we talk much about the gang shootings here in Anchorage. Now you've been south for a little while, but we do have many, many established gangs in town right now, and they're shooting at each other all the time. But there were a lot of shootings in 4th Avenue and down in East Chester Flats. And one other case I tried, a cab driver named Roberts went out and shot another cab driver. There were some hotels, motels way out on Spinard Road that rented rooms by the hour. And a couple of the cab drivers got in a bit of a squabble over who was, whose territory was whose, so far as bringing people out to the ladies. And a cab driver named Roberts shot another cab driver several times in the back with a rifle. Wendell Kay, who is still the best lawyer I've ever had experience with, convinced the jury that it was self-defense. Four bullet holes in the back, and the jury found him not guilty.
Well, that was a marvelous attorney. Right?
I believe Roberts later, I don't know this, I didn't try the case, but I believe Roberts later shot somebody else and was convicted.
What types of court-related things other than trials did you do on the bench? Committees, conferences, those types of things?
Practically none.
You avoided that.
Yeah, I was, all of us felt like the Lone Ranger. You may recall they had a real trouble getting me to come to judicial conferences. In fact, I have a letter that I treasure from Chief Justice Rabinowitz directing me to come to the judicial conference in Big Lake, and no excuses would be accepted. Frankly, I just never felt anything got done in a community, in a committee setting. And I studiously avoided committee work.
Yeah, you were involved in a number of community, and actually you talked about CAPS, Civil Air Patrol, and things like that. What type of community things did you involve yourself in?
Well, I was president of the Kenai Peninsula Hockey Association for a number of years. I coached hockey for 4 years, and I coached Little League. I worked with the Boy Scouts. I was very active with Civil Patrol. I think I probably flew well over 1,000 hours in search missions. That's because the Kenai Court wasn't very busy. I'd get a call from police during the court day and say, "Can you get away quickly? Because there's a boat circling out at Skelak Lake with nobody in it. Can you fly over there and take a look?" And usually I could. Mm-hmm. So I'd go over there, and I remember on the occasion that, you know, I'm discussing, I would get to the lake just as the boat beached itself. And I flew there for an hour and a half, about 50 feet over the water, looking for a body, but the gentleman didn't pop up for about a month. They always come to the service after a while.
When did you get your pilot's license?
I got my pilot's license in, I think, 1970.
And was that influenced by the fact that so many people did fly their own airplanes?
It was. I was and am afraid of flying. And people were asking me to go with them. The population had grown to the point you really couldn't drive out of town for an hour and shoot a moose and be back home by noon. You had to get out somewhere, and so people were asking me to go with them, and I was so afraid of flying that I couldn't go. So I finally went and bought an inexpensive airplane, took my flight physical, and went over to an instructor. I bought the plane. I said, "There's my plane. Here's my physical. Here's my problem. I'm scared to death of flying." And they still laugh, the instructor and his friends. Because I would get into the seat on the airplane, and when the seat belt clicked, the foot began to pour. And by the time I would get out, taxi out, and be ready for takeoff, I was soaking wet. It took me 14 or 15 hours to solo, which is usual now because of FAA requirements, but in those days, people usually soloed in 4 hours or less. I was still shaking.
But you overcame it.
I did. When I fly the airplane, I feel perfectly fine. And if I'm sitting in the right seat, well, for instance, when my wife's flying the plane, I feel pretty good because I have a whole set of controls there. But if I'm in the back seat of an airplane, a small airplane, I go through the same fear of flying business. I don't have any problem at all getting into commercial airplanes.
Well, we are fairly safe.
Yeah.
What did you find most satisfying in your career as a judge?
The juvenile aspect, when they worked out. I felt there that we were, that I was accomplishing something. Some of the civil criminal cases, I, I sentence people in my early career that I'm getting letters from as recently as 5 or 6 years ago telling me if it wasn't for me, they would have. That made me feel pretty good. I can't remember any civil case that I felt real good about the result in. But the criminal, where you're dealing with people's lives, as you are in the criminal juvenile arenas, there's a lot of job satisfaction there.
And how about the most frustrating part of your tenure on the bench? And please don't say it was me.
Well, no, Art, after you left, I found a lot of frustration with the administration. I got a distinct feeling that the tail was wagging the dog here now. That came to light one particular day. I came up here and agreed to try a case, and the lawyers had a witness who was costing them $7,000 a day up here from the South 48, and they came and asked me if we could go late so they could get rid of this witness and didn't have to pay him for the next day. He had a reservation on, and I said, sure. I asked the clerk if she could stay late. She said, I'm willing to, but I can't. I said, what do you mean you can't? And she said, we have to have permission from administration before I can work overtime. Oh, I said, that's no problem. I went down to the trial court administrator, and he says, out of my hands. We have to get permission from the court system administrator for anybody to work overtime. And you'll remember I was a little independent of your in those days.
Oh, I thought we had a marvelous working relationship.
Oh, I did too. I did too. And I tried to do what was good, and then if you didn't like it, I did it my way. But anyway, I tried not to embarrass you.
And you never did, Jim.
So I then told the clerk to please leave a number of tapes stacked up next to the recording machine. Told her that when she came in the morning, I'd like her to listen to the testimony that we took. And I presided from the clerk station for the balance of the day. It went about three and a half extra hours. And the doctor got on his way to Illinois or wherever he was from. But I was so annoyed by the fact that administration was so firmly in charge of everything by that time that a trial judge couldn't make a decision to go 3 hours longer. But that was, those were in my pro tem days. Frustrations. I don't think I would have stayed around as long as I did if I was terribly frustrated while I was full-time judge.
I mean, I'll say you were very easy to work with and all. Very willing to help both giving me ideas to talk to the delegation from the peninsula about and helping out when we needed help elsewhere. So I mean,
I enjoyed being a judge. You'll remember we got to the point where we needed more than one judge on the P9, but didn't think we needed two, so I decided to go halftime. Built another courtroom in that old courthouse, and I worked there about 8 months, a year as a senior judge, and Bob Fisher, who was the accounting person for the courtroom, the court system worked out a very complex method of giving me retirement credit for my pro tem work, and life was good.
Well,
but when it got to the point where one and a half judges, and you know, wasn't enough anymore, they needed two, I certainly didn't leave angry. I just left. We then moved to Anchorage, and I found myself working nearly full time in this program.
From your standpoint, was there anything that you can think of, any significant things that you wanted to accomplish within the court system that you were able to do to make it a better system? I mean, better communications or whatever, in any area,
did I feel I could take credit for? No, I think
I really think that I was instrumental in getting a lot more communication between the judges here. When there were only four judges here, they talked to each other a lot. Then this place, it got to the point where the judges weren't meeting anymore. We used to have every Friday meetings, most of which Ed Burke and I would leave after an hour and a half of discussing the same thing over and over again. But the judges weren't walking down the hall to talk to each other. They weren't necessarily angry at each other, but I would run around and sort of walk in on everybody and chat with them for a bit, and then next thing we were, two of us would be walking down and talking to another judge about this thing that we perceived to be a problem. And you may remember the time you and Jay, or Justice Rabinowitz, asked me to go to Fairbanks. And we went there for 6 months, and the object of the exercise was to get the judges getting along.
It was.
I just felt that this was a job you shouldn't be totally lonely in. You just have to talk to people about a problem you're having with a case or the administration office, whatever it is, you should be talking about it.
Well, you were always very forthright with administration, and we appreciated that. At least I appreciated that. Administration, as you know, tried to, in its own way, to be creative and helpful, as you mentioned, Bob Fisher and those types of things. So we're all in it together, so to speak.
I wish that attitude prevailed now. It doesn't. I don't think it's Stephanie's fault. I think she's doing it, but there are layers of bureaucracy now that are in that building that you know about over there.
Yeah.
One of the more annoying days I hadn't worked pro tem for about 6 months, and Judge Mahalski called and said a case had been sent back, a domestic relations case that I had done, had been sent back for further findings. And he wanted to know if I would please come in and do that, otherwise he'd have to listen to the whole record, so on and so forth. So I said, sure. I will do that. It's going to take me a couple of days to get up to speed on the case. I don't remember it at all. I'm sure my notes are around somewhere, and they hit on them. So I came over and thought, well, I'm going to park. My wife had the car, and we had that camper van that you might remember when I picked up in. It wouldn't go in the garage. So I asked the judge's secretary to call over to administration to see if I could park in one of the parking places next to the Snowden building. And she was told, no, these parking places are for administration. It'll be up to the trial court administrator to find some place that Judge Hansen can park.
Well, those things can cause a bad hair day.
So I took a cab downtown, and then Judge Mosso gave me a ride home at 8. But I just can't imagine how unreasonably angry that made me. I thought, my gosh, I've gone from being somebody to nobody to I never was so fast, I can't believe it.
I understand that feeling.
When I told Stephanie about it a couple of days later, she was unavailable that morning. She was pretty upset. And I think she had a chat with the administrative person over there who made that decision.
Well, having spent with the system through its formative years, and it's grown into an adult system, let's face it. When in the early years, the Department of Administration controlled the budget, and I remember there was a time when there was almost a court case over whether judges could give donuts to jurors, because the Department of Administration wasn't going to allow it. And when the Department of Transportation built our buildings, as they built the Kenai Courthouse, and had no concept of what a courthouse should look like, until, let's say, it's morphed into an adult system where it's a real third branch of government. What do you think are the main strengths of the system that you observed over time while you were here?
Well, I'm very, very impressed by the judges we have now. Therefore, I thank the judicial, the Missouri plan, or as I call it, of appointing judges, is working. I meet these young kids that are on the bench now, and they are so bright. And to my knowledge, they're all working very hard. And so I think one of the strengths has been the selection. I've often thought that the Judicial Council and the Judicial Conduct Commission were getting way too much money and doing far more than they're supposed to do. But it's working. The period, as I talk to the very few judges that I know well enough to talk about, I think this period where the administration was working so hard to be in control has sort of gone by the way. Judges tell me how no one would question it if they wanted to go late, so on. I think the fact that all the judges have law clerks now, which initially we didn't. The judges are well supported, in my opinion, by administration. I think, thanks to you, we got the legislature got used to funding the court system. And as I watch the legislature in action here now, I hear very few grandstanding legislators talking about cutting the court system's budget anymore. I sort of like that, and the pay raise that we all got this year, just astounding. I don't know who's responsible. I called Stephanie to thank her and congratulate her, and she sort of brushed it off as if she hadn't done much, but that's the largest increase proportionally we've ever had. I, as a retired judge, did well.
Yes, I am under the same system as you are,
yeah.
As you know. I think
I'd like to put on record the Kenai Courthouse battle. We, the Department of, what was it?
Transportation.
And Public Facilities.
Yeah.
Hired an architect, I'm telling the record, not you, because you know this, hired an architect who obviously knew nothing of courthouses. He came down to Kenai and talked to me for several hours. I told him what I had in mind, and then we got the plans for this abomination that wouldn't work under any circumstances, couldn't work. And I recall a meeting in which I was there, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court was there, Ralph Moody, the presiding judge of the Third Judicial District, was there, and you were there. I don't know whether Ed, the architect from Hawaii, had been engaged yet at that time, but all of us were telling these bureaucrats why this court system wouldn't work, why we had to do this, and then I remember one of them looking at you and at Chief Justice Rabinowitz and saying, we have the authority to determine building design. We may or may not consider your objections. How anybody could look at the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, two other Superior Court judges and the Administrative Director and be so arrogant, something I never fathomed. Well, you quickly fixed that way legislation in the next couple of years.
Well, I remember that occasion also. I think our rejoinder to them was that you can build a building, but we won't be moving into it.
Yeah.
You will have an empty building. It'll be quite an embarrassment. It was then that they agreed to let us bring in an architect to try to fix what could be fixed at that late date.
Some changes.
Not many, but because they were too far along. But I remember that incident well. Now, what do you feel, Jim? Looking back and into the future, what are the main challenges of our justice system today? Not just the courts, but the entire justice system.
I don't think the answer to every problem is the throwing people in jail. I had a reputation for either long sentences, if someone was a danger to the public and should be taken off the street, or very short sentences, because I didn't think any good was done to anybody by a 4 or 5 year sentence. It would never come out better. And then for the really dangerous people, I took them out of circulation as long as I could. Now, we simply do not have, they're talking about building one up in the valley, but there isn't enough, there aren't enough prison beds available for the people who really need to be there. I think because of presumptive sentencing, which the legislature imposed on us very unwisely, there are a large number of people in jail who don't need to be there. We've got a whole lot of natives from rural Alaska who are sitting down in Florence, Arizona in a contract prison who haven't benefited, and neither has their community, from anything longer than a 1 year sentence. Take a young man from Eek, Alaska, 18 or 19 going on 14, give him the presumptive sentence that the legislature demands, and then send him to Florence, Arizona for 6 or 7 years, and then bring him back to Eek. Insane.
Well, I can't disagree with that. We've been warehousing people, and especially our native population, for many, many years. What do you think about as an offshoot, about some of this tribal court activity? Is it good, bad?
I don't know, frankly. I've had very, very little contact with it out in the bush. I have talked to judges who serve out there, who feel both ways about it. And I think tribal court attention is better than no attention from anybody. And there are just a lot of the things that I believe they're dealing with we simply haven't been able to get to.
They've been experimenting here with therapeutic courts, I guess, trying to divert some people from prison life. Does that seem to work at all, or do you?
I think so. I've talked to the judges that have handled it here and in Fairbanks and out in Bethel. And I think that in Bethel, the judge that's been trying to do it has been doing a very good job, but he simply doesn't have the time it takes. Now, the legislature this year has authorized at least one more judge for Bethel. And I think when they get to be a three-judge court, then their therapeutic court is going to work much better. I've heard good things about what it has done here. I don't know who's doing it now that Judge Wanamaker is gone.
They're still working on it here, I believe, though I'm not any more up to date than you are. You're probably more up to date than I am.
Initially, I thought it was nonsense. I did. I didn't express that opinion until I looked around a bit, and I think a lot of people that went through that were served far better than if we had just tucked them in the bucket for a year.
Looking back on your life, to today, all the way back to today, were there any people or events in your life that had a particularly profound influence on you?
Well, Arlen Banfield, I think, that was my second father. The value system that dictated the method of practicing law in that firm was, in those days, absolutely glorious. I mean, you know, Judge Bucci very well. More than once he told me, Jim, we're not going to tolerate. I made the mistake once of when they lost a case in the Supreme Court of saying, well, you win a few, you lose a few. And that's the only time he ever became very angry with me, let me know it. And yet, on the other hand, they did a lot of pro bono work before pro bono was. So I would say Bucci and Banfield and that firm, very, very I had a profound effect on my life. I took a lot from every judge that I ever worked with. Cumulatively, I learned a lot from Ed Burke and Jim Singleton, the older judges. I don't think I ever learned anything from Ed Davis, but I learned a lot from Ralph Bodie, curmudgeon that he was.
I learned a lot from Ralph Bodie too. I loved his, he made cases move. He said, you don't like it, take the elevator upstairs, and he ruled though.
So whether there were any, Chief Justice Nesbitt and I were, I fought and he enjoyed my fighting with him. After I changed that countering procedure that I told you about to one that I triple set everybody, I got a memorandum from Tom Stewart, administrative director, saying Justice Nesbitt wants to know why you've changed the countering procedure from that set up by somebody who was an early administrator. And because I was terribly, terribly unreasonable in those days, I sent back a memorandum and said I changed it because it's better. Tom then came down and talked to me, and he said, I'm not going to show this memo to the Chief Justice. He's not criticizing you. He just wants to know what your reasons were and how it's working. Well, I'm still another. So I had the clerks of court dig up all of the, run statistics on how many cases had been resolved in the 6 months after I changed it and the time before that. And I had all that sent up to Justice Nesbitt. I thought that would explain it. But I guess there was still some sarcasm in my memo because he called me up there and I walked in and he said, what the hell's the matter with you? And I said, what do you mean? He said, I wasn't criticizing you. Damn it. I like what you've done, but I don't like your attitude. and then I had the battle of the dictaphones, and I frequently went straight to his office when I had a complaint. And then he had his airplane crash and finally retired. And then when I became a candidate for the Supreme Court, I got a call from retired Justice Nesbitt, wanting to know what he could do to help. Well, Buell, I said, maybe you should write a letter opposing me. No, I said, I really appreciate it. And if you would write a letter to the Judicial Council on my behalf, the fact that you approve of anybody, I think would have a significant impact. And he wrote a nice letter and copied me. But the way he ran this court system without very much help, I remember so clearly the battle of the Bar Association and the Supreme Court. I watched it from my neutral territory down there in the district court.
Cost Justice Aarons his job.
And he was the nicest man you'll ever want to know. And everybody was heartbroken when he, but I remember when Justice Nesbitt sent Tom Stewart and a trooper named Sam Henley over to the First National Bank of Alaska to seize the bar funds. And they set them up, except the camera didn't work. The headline on the paper came out just hours later, bar funds seized at gunpoint. But they didn't get the picture of Sam Henley showing his gun because the bank official said, it would really help our position if you showed me your gun.
I heard the story that the bank official called his attorney, and the attorney said, does he have a gun? And would you ask him to show it to you? Now you can give him the money.
Well, it was Roger Cremo, and Roger Cremo disliked Buell enormously. And between Roger Cremo, the bank's attorney,
And Mr. Cuddy, the president of the bank, they set him up. He didn't have to call anybody, he'd been given the script. And I don't remember who was up on that balcony in the old 4th Avenue Bank with a camera, but the camera missed. But for the article to appear just an hour or two after, obviously Bob Atwood was in on it too. Bar fund seized at gunpoint.
Well, in wrapping up, Jim, you're retired, but you're not tired. Retired. Tell how much time are you spending on judicial-related things, and what are you doing?
I'm not doing anything in the court system anymore. I'm really out of touch. The rules have changed significantly. A lot of cases have been down to the Supreme Court that I'd really have to get up to speed again before I could do a case. And the Constitution says you aren't supposed to be a judge if you're over 70, and I'm 72.
Right.
But I'm doing, I call settlement conferences. Somebody else might call it mediation. I'm simply not touchy-feely enough to be a mediator. I'm not interested in people getting in touch with their feelings. I want them to get in touch with reality and understand their case isn't worth $1 million. And the other side to realize that it's not a slam dunk and they should settle. So I have been, between the months of April and October, the end of October, for the last several years, doing about 3 of those a week. I feel really good about it when they settle. Didn't get too much done this summer because I had new knees put in that took me out of commission for about 6 weeks, and then I had another surgery that took me out of it. So I haven't done all that much this summer. Hopefully I'll get back into it next year, because the satisfaction, and there are a number of us doing this, by the way. Mark Rowan is doing it, Judge Chertel is doing this, Ripley has really made it a huge business. Former Justice Compton is doing it. Elaine Andrews is doing a lot of it. And there's no question in my mind that among all the efforts of all the retired judges, we're disposing of more cases than they can possibly be doing over at the courthouse.
Which helps both the retired judges and the court system.
Yeah. None of us are charging anywhere near what the mediators, or whatever you call them, are charging in the South 48. I went down and visited the people with JAMS, the West Coast Judicial Arbitration Service, and I think they're charging about $750 an hour with a 4-hour minimum, whether they get it, or a 7-hour minimum, whether they get it done in an hour or seven. I don't know anybody here that's charging more than $300 an hour. Sounds like a heck of a lot of money, but a whole lot of us are charging less than the attorneys who are.
Yes.
Of course, we should have gotten used to that as judges. I know that for several years, the district attorneys, also public servants, were getting paid more than we were as Superior Court judges. Again, I'm glad you were here. That changed.
And in October, you head for where? Arizona?
Arizona. Because my wife would like me to call it a modular home or a manufactured home out away from any town, 2.5 acres in the desert with occasionally, when it rains, a stream passing through and lots of wild animals, and we stayed there. Through the winter months, I don't have all that trouble, much trouble with cold and snow, but the darkness really began to get to me. And so we go down there now as soon as the days are longer in Arizona than they are here, and we come back on the same schedule.
And when you're down there, what do you do?
I shoot, trap, and skeet a lot. Now that I have my new knees, I intend to do a lot more hiking with my wife, who's 66, going on
35. We have four-wheelers that we take into the mountains. They have a lot of old logging and mining roads that you can go on there. Read quite a lot. Last summer I spent a lot of time outlining a book that I may or may not write. I think if I put the word out that I'm writing a book, I may get a lot of people who will pay me not to write it. Although those people are nearly all dead now, which is what I've been waiting for before writing it. And I take a nap in the afternoon. We're always very busy. I get up in the morning with nothing to do, and by the time I go to bed, I'm only half done.
I understand that completely. Well, I'd like to say, at least on my behalf, that I truly believe you're a great asset to this institution. You're held down the Kenai Peninsula. You went out to the bush. You, when called upon, you hardly ever refused. As you alluded to, you took on that difficult task in Fairbanks that Justice Rabinowitz and I asked you to take on. You gave me counsel as to the legislative delegation from the Kenai Peninsula, which was much appreciated. And you were a good friend. And well, I thank you for all of that.
Art, I'd like to reciprocate almost everything you've said. I felt we were good friends. Times when I was really discouraged, I felt I could come up and just chat, and never were you too busy. And the court system came a long, long way. A lot of people giggle about the Snowden Building being named before you're dead, but I'm glad they did.
Well, as Alex Brenner said, it's the thought that counts.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim.
Mutual Admiration Society.
You guys did great.